ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
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 की जय। सो रीडिंग फ्रॉम आवर स्लेव लेबर प्रोजेक्ट फॉर देम नाउ An interesting feature of chapter 1, canto 2 is the revelation, how one may come to know the universe as it really is, nimesha. As you know, nimesha means inserted comment. In other words, any credit or blame for this, these words that appear in these brackets fall either at my feet or on my head. So aim as you like. Praise or blame, it all goes my way. It's not true, probably. So, nimesha, in philosophy, I just want to point out, is I gave a little editorial remark yesterday how my view, and I've been speaking with Maharaj and he shares this opinion, is that this Bhagavatam class is meant to bring us, I've said it before, to the Nishta platform, and Nishta means fearless. And what in this Kali Yuga are we, you know, our this fearless quality is supposed to be engaged in, that is preaching. As Srila Prabhupada used to say about himself, is that he was a common sense person, not formally trained. I mean, he had a British education, but he was more, I think he said his favorite subject was, our godbrother in Vrindavan runs the housing project, English.
Dhananjaya,
Prabhu. He actually told me, and Brahmananda Maharaj too, Brahmananda Prabhu. The Prabhupada once said his favorite subject in school was history. So, but he used to meet with physicists and, you know, psychologists fearlessly. And he used to cut their legs out from underneath them using a combination of common sense and Bhagavad philosophy. So that's what it means in our terms, practical, you know, in the practical sense, nishta. And that's just an asterisk to what I was talking about yesterday. If we are facing, on the horizon, there are growing black clouds of war. An ideological warfare is building up in this world. And the subject matter of this warfare is Vedic knowledge. And in terms of expanding Vedic knowledge through to the intellectuals, the Shaivites, the Mayavadis, the Shaktas, the Agora Tantrics are way ahead of us. I mean, we've made some splashes like with forbidden archaeology, but I mean, in terms of real impact, they're way ahead of us. So this is why in this Nimesha I bring up the subject matter that we will just read now. In philosophy, the exploration of the question, what is existence in reality, is called ontology. Oh my God. Big word. What does it mean? So keep reading. Actually, you find out it's very simple. The primary syllable of this word, on, is derived from Greek, and is etymologically another, you know, we used to say way back when 50 cent words, but now we'd have to say like $5 words or something, maybe even $50 words. But, okay, another $50 word, etymologically, what is that? That means the, actually, it's important, because before Western scholarship discovered the Sanskrit language, there was no such field of study as etymology. There was no such understanding that there was a common ground to languages. They were just different languages. Then when they stumbled upon Sanskrit, the British, in, as they gradually colonized this country, they started to notice the similarity of the, what we call the Prakrit forms, say Bengali, Orion, Bihari, etc., etc., Maharashtrian, Hindi to a lesser extent, because there's a lot of Turkish. Hindi is a market language, so there's actually the main language of Pakistan, Urdu, is just means Hindi with more Turkish in it, yeah. You know. And Hindustani, which is the formal way you speak of, you know, what we mean when we say Hindi, Hindustani just means more Sanskritic words than the Turkic words. But there's a lot of Turkic words in Hindi. And anyway, so to a lesser extent Hindi, but certainly Bengali is a very Sanskritic language. But Arvagisha is not here, but as I understand it, they throw out the grammar right away. You got the vocabulary if you're fortunate enough to have been born in India and you're speaking, you know, you grew up speaking a Sanskrit-derived language, then you have the good fortune of having the vocabulary behind you that makes learning that aspect of Sanskrit very easy, because you can see the connection. I mean, I lately, because I just stumbled upon this very rare dictionary in four volumes in Calcutta at Motilal, and I bought it, and then the next time I came in I was haggling about the price, and then the guy told me, you remember that four volume dictionary you bought? He said, that is so rare you probably won't get another one for another 10 years. And that was that dictionary was begun in 1912 and finished in 1968 by a husband and wife who spent their whole life. It's an overview of the Indo-European family of languages, starting with Sanskrit and then going into all Indian languages and then going even outside. So I've been looking at that a lot lately, and English, I want to actually, it's one of my prayers, to actually do a dictionary of just a few thousand words that will be directly related in some way or other to Sanskrit, so that as we teach our boys English, they'll be learning, they'll be becoming acquainted with Sanskrit. But it's just more indirect, like the other day I found... I think it's, you know, it's probably pronounced somewhat differently, but the word values, I found the word alligator in the Sanskrit. And there was no asterisk, means, which means, some of the words have asterisks, which means there's certain rules, because Bharat Muni invented Prakrit, so you turn those rules in reverse and you get back to the Sanskrit, which you may not find in any scripture, because actually, although the Sanskrit scriptures, the total encyclopedia collection of Vedic scriptures makes the Iliad and the Odyssey of, you know, Rome and what of ancient Greece and whatever else was there, and the Roman scriptures and even the Chinese scriptures look like dictionaries compared to the Encyclopedia Britannica. More than half of the total volume of all of Shastra that was ever recorded by Vyasadeva's disciples is lost. That's known. Because that's one of the criticisms the Mayavadis like to make about Madhvacharya, because he quotes from scriptures that you can't find. And then they say, he just made that up. Because these are scriptures which are, you know, the quotations are clearly saying Krishna is God. Some this or that Upanishad, you know, Vedic scripture. And the Mayavadis are saying, where is it? But what they don't understand is that, as, or what they didn't understand in those days, you see, because actually that's the credit for the Westerners who came to India, and they became excited about this etymology. That's where it started. When they saw, first of all, the relationship of this classical Sanskrit, which is sort of like Latin, you know, in Europe. There's Latin or Greek, ancient Greek. There are still some specialists who can even speak these languages, but, you know, the common man can't. Or you take a language like English. The earliest written down work that's known in Europe, it was actually written down and saved, because even the Greek and Roman literatures were discovered later, because the Christians, the glorious Christians in the Middle Ages, they, just like the Muslims also, when they came to the great Alexandrian library, which was filled with scriptures collected all over the known civilized world, they set it ablaze, and it took 3 months to burn. There were so many scriptures, and there were definitely scriptures from India. That's definitely known. It took 3 months for that library to burn down. There were so many books. And the general, the Islamic general who ordered that it be burnt, he said, what's the use of this library? He said, if there are books that agree with the Quran, fine. But then we have the Quran, so what do we need those books for? And if there are books that disagree with the Quran, which I'm sure there are many, then they should be burned. So you remember how shocked you may know, if I don't know what the younger generation learns, but I remember when I grew up in school, you know, it was drilled into our head that nightmarish scene in Germany in Berlin, Alexanderplatz, when they had a book burning festival, the Nazis, after they just took over Germany. One of the first things they did was burn all the books that were written by Jewish authors, or, you know, just anyone who wasn't writing Nazi racist philosophy, throw it on the bonfire. And that was that. That's like, was always presented to us as horrendous, you know. But the Christians did it. And where did the Nazis learn it from? They learned it from the Christians of the Middle Ages, who just totally let these Greek and Roman scriptures get lost. And it was actually other Muslims, intellectuals, not that general who burned the Alexandrian library, but other, especially the ones in Spain, like Al-Biruni, they rediscovered these scriptures and they started translating them. And that was the first exposure the Europeans got of the Greek and Roman philosophy. It wasn't in the original language, it was in Arabic. And even they started to learn Greek and Roman, and they translated in reverse. to get to them first. That's the first edition of the Upanishads was done that way, translated in reverse, not from Sanskrit, but from Arabic. And I've seen that edition, and so weird. If you see a properly translated version of the Upanishads, they're completely different. But still, it impressed the West. You know, it's a completely wacko translation. But anyway, that's how etymology started, with the discovery of Sanskrit. So I was mentioning Beowulf. That's actually original Anglo-Saxon. As far as I know, that's the oldest original European literature, you know, that was still around in its original form. And that goes back to 800 BC, 800 years after Christ. And if any of us were to see Beowulf, you know, we may have gotten straight A's, and like our dear David here, who is our English, local English teacher, who is very expert, but you put a volume of Beowulf in front of him and he'll just scratch his head because that English had 8 cases, and you know, that English was a lot like Sanskrit and completely unrecognizable. So it was even written in a different kind of script. The sound, which is pretty unique to English, because everyone else says, like in Sanskrit, ta, but we say the, which is, and we say, you know, the F sound, whereas in English, whenever you hear Prabhupada give a lecture, he always goes, pa, you know. So, you know, he will say, so this word is formed, or when he said woman, he would not pronounce the W, because it doesn't exist in Sanskrit. He would say uman, uman. He would not say woman, because it just doesn't exist, that sound, in Sanskrit. So, like the TH in original English script is like a O with a line. I think it's going from top to bottom. It might be going from right to left. I've forgotten now. And then if it appears, that's if it appears in the beginning, and if it appears inside, then it's a different form. And you wouldn't even know what to do with it if you saw it. You know, you wouldn't know, what's that? You know, but that's, so anyway, English used to be a very different language. And so they all started discovering these things, and the relationship of these languages. And it's moved from first it was more or less Indo-European was a very select group. It was Sanskrit, Greek, and Latin, first of all. Then they admitted Germanic languages, German, because German scholars got, you know, they rapidly followed the English, and they said, hey, wait a minute. Wir sind auch da. We're also there. All right, make room for the crowds. And then the Swedes got in there. Well, what about us? I don't know how you say that in Swedish. Maybe, where's our little lovely, he's not here?
He's here.
Uda? Or is he sleeping? Oh, there he is. Do you know how you say? Where are we in Swedish?
Varavi.
Huh? Varavi. Varavi. Oh, very similar. Yeah, it's very similar to English. And you know, so one by one, the Europeans, they all, the Spanish, you know, banged on the door. What about us? The Italians, they had their Sanskritists. What about us? We're there too. You let in Latin, you got to let in us too, because our language comes from Latin. So, you know, it's just expanded. Then even Hungarians, We have our prime examples sitting right there. Even they started banging on the door and went, what about us? And the Finnish. And, you know, so now the Indo-European language group is quite extensive. And now they're proposing what they call Nostratic. That there was originally one language in the world. And, anyway, I may have been talking about that the other day. But anyway, this whole science of etymology started with the discovery of Sanskrit and its relationship to other Indian languages before there was no such. And that's become a great science. And it's all due to this discovery of Sanskrit. So, anyway, to get back to the point, let's continue. I always had this tendency to give these lengthy asterisk footnotes to these simple points. So anyway, in philosophy, the explanation of the question, what is existence in reality, is called ontology. The primary symbol of this word, that means, what do we used to say, the operative? Mm. Yeah. So in a sentence, there's an operative word, like the main word. You know, especially in nasty sentences, where you're telling somebody to do something, so that thing you're telling them to do, that becomes the, you know, operative word. But it also exists in nice, but we are such low-class background, this is the only thing we can think about. So, anyway, please forgive me, that's my conditioning. So anyway, it is derived from Greek, but it, etymologically, it is related to the word on as we use it in English. This is an interesting point because it belongs to the same general family. It's not that the word on in English goes back to Greek. It exists in English also. And it just, because it's the same family, it means the same thing. What do we mean when we say on? Here's a table. Here's some cartels. I put the table on the cartels. What does that mean? It means the table is the support of the cartels. So that's all ontology is about. Big word, but it just means in either language, the meaning of on is basically the same. Thus, ontology, a highbrow word that many English speakers are not familiar with, and when they hear it, they become scared. Ontology, what is he saying? What is that? And all it means is whatever it is that holds us all up. Whatever is the support of everything. The universe, is it the universe that supports us? Reality, what is reality? So the Vedic conclusion is that this on, you know, this which is underneath us, keeping us in our place and existence, is that is being searched for by philosophers and scientists is, and I've underlined, not material. The Vedic goal of ontology, or you would say, I guess that would be tattvava. Would you agree? The search for, you know, or, you know, tattvaism, the ism of reality, realityism.
But it could be, but I think
the study of reality
would be something. Because you're looking for the source of everything.
Or the support of everything. Source and support, yeah. And also conclusion, ultimately it. But they start, ontology means, they start with is, because the big question is. Actually, that's the biggest question. Because you notice there's a strange thing.
Is that
existence means now. And now is something so ephemeral. Because now is disappearing at every instant. What is now? That's a very big question. Because soon as I ask this question, it's already in the past. It's already gone. You know, as soon as we start talking about it, we talk about now, but we're not in the now as we talk about it. So that's one of the interesting questions. It's a very simple thing in one sense, but it's very deep. And that's what ontology is about, you know, because that's where you begin. You begin with the isness of things, and that's already so hard to get. Because as soon as, you know, you have to go through a mental process, you know, somewhere in your consciousness, the conception of now arises, and then it has to be translated into, you know, it goes from like an instinct, like Wittgenstein said, in his youth, he said, language is a vehicle of thought, and then in his old age, after much consideration, he finally concluded that language is thought. But thought means, you know, you've got to form a sentence. That's actually the original meaning of logic, which is another word, you know. Logic! But the simplest meaning of logic is just logos means word in Greek. And it's, you know, and the simplest form, you were telling me, Vagish was telling me, the simplest form of logic is, also in the Vedic world, is grammar. There's a logic to grammar. And that's the simplest form of logic. So, but that takes time. You know, then you've got to, you think, just, and the time it takes you to think, what is reality or what is ontology, you know, what is this is, then that is already gone. It's already in the past. You know. So it's such a, you know, interesting problem. So anyway, again, excuse me for the big footnote. That shows you why the Vedic conclusion is that it is not material. How can it be material? Because time is standing in the way from us really getting any grasp on what that foundation is, that, you know, what that is. Time stands in the way. So the Vedic goal of ontology is indicated by Srila Prabhupada in this excerpt from his purport, the Bhagavatam. This is sangati within the Bhagavatam. Sangati means you show the relationship. And so I'm doing a lot of sangati within the Bhagavatam itself, because that's important for us. Since we're studying the Bhagavatam, it's important for us to see how the Bhagavatam relates to the Bhagavatam, because the Bhagavatam is a huge scripture. 12 cantos. Officially stated 18,000 verses. But I think it counts up to, well, it depends on how you break it up, but you can even come up to how you break them up, even more than 18,000. Anyway, 18,000 verses, that's a lot of verses. So, Bhagavatam 4, Canto 4, chapter 30, verse 43. Prabhupada says, the word Anapavarga Virya is significant in this verse. The word Ana means without. Pavarga means the materialistic way of life. And Virya means prowess. The prowess of the Supreme Personality of Godhead always contains six basic opulences, one of which is vairagya. Prabhupada doesn't use the word. He uses the word renunciation. But it's important, vairagya, because that also relates back to virya. From virya, the word, continuing, vira, the cosmic manifestation, is derived. Anapavarga means, however, that the materialistic conception of the universe, which is our present conception, when we look at this universe with our senses and we think about it with our mind, you know, unless we are at that platform of Vasudeva Sattva, because that's the minimum qualification for getting a real understanding of, you know, the isness of the universe, unless you're there, unless the three modes of nature is no longer working on your consciousness, you can't catch it. So, rather, of the six opulences of the Lord's prowess, because that's what how Prabhupada defines prowess, the Shad Aishwarya, one is Vairagya. Now you can see the similarity. You can see Vairagya, Virya, Vira. You can see the similarity, which Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu personally demonstrated by accepting sannyas. Srila Prabhupada additionally renders Anupabhagya Virya as meaning the Lord's prowess cannot be defeated. Hence, the materialistic program, you know, in other words, how do the materialists see the universe? It's the place of eat, drink, be merry, for life is but a dream. There's an English song that we learned when we were children. Unfortunately, we don't hear. Now that I'm going to sing it, I suppose I'm going to hear the boys sing it now, you know, in their playtime. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. You know, which is a nice nursery rhyme for Maya Shunya Nirvishesha Shunya. Philosophy. Since life is but a dream, then just have fun, you know, because otherwise it's meaningless. You know, that's Charvak philosophy, Lokayata. And that's in the West, because they're all Malechas, that, you know, at least in India, Nirvishesha Shunyavadi, classical Mayavad and classical Buddhism means, it means, as Prabhupada says, apavarga, without the materialistic conception. At least that much they understand. Already in that sense, even the atheists, or the, you know, the crypto-atheists are much more advanced in the West, because at least their acharyas, Adi Shankara and Lord Buddha, taught them you cannot realize that unless you control the senses. But in the West, they don't know that. In the West, they learn this stuff from people like Arthur Schopenhauer, you know. We don't want to talk about their dietary habits and their drinking, you know, the kind of beverages they drank, you know. But you can just imagine. And when they were writing, you can just imagine. I mean, I once actually read an article in one of my favorite magazines, which the boys all know. I won't mention the name of, but the boys have explored these magazines very carefully. And in one of those issues, there was a whole study. It's a science type of magazine, but it's the, you know, the leading edge or the far out side of scientific exploration. So there was an article on how much Western civilization, the things that have happened in the West, and the ideas that have been formulated in the West, and the, you know, the words spoken by great men, how much of that has come out of the state of intoxication. You know, it's amazing, you know. You know, how much before Winston Churchill made, you know, he's considered one of the masters of modern English language, you know, and how much bourbon he consumed before he got up and made his speeches, you know. He would be applauded, but the guy was drunk out of his mind, you know. And anyway, this is all very interesting, because this is in our, this will be one of the, in our orientation book that we're working on, this is going to be one of the main points, that it, inspiration to be a kavi, they used to also in Vedic times have an intoxicant, but it was soma. And what soma did was clear all the nadis, so that light would enter the body, the light from the eyes of the Lord, either the sun or the moon. It's, soma means the moon, so but the sun also. So and the nadis, soma purified the nadis, means the subtle, the nerves of actually the subtle body. There's a We have our gross nervous system, just like we have a gross brain, which is the CNS, the central nervous system. It's the main lump of ganglia. No, it's just a bunch of neurons all collected together. It's the biggest one. We have others. You know, actually the chakras, there's one Japanese scientist, Miyamoto, who has discovered the chakra. There's ganglia correspondence, but actually these nadi in Sanskrit means the nerves of the subtle body, which is something, you know, beyond the gross body. So soma, ras, if you were qualified to participate, you had to be a brahmana. You had to be a brahmana on the level of the demigods. Because actually this is first of all offered to Indra, and that's how you get it, because Indra is the lord of the senses. So you have to give it to Indra first. And Indra absorbs it, and because he takes it, and because he takes it, and he's residing in your body, then you get it. So it means you have to be like on speaking terms with Indradev. And then you can derive, you get his remnant, you see. And then that would clear out the nadis so that you would see the astral light. Astral meaning the light of the heavenly bodies, which are mainly the sun and the moon, which are the eyes of the Lord. And we were talking yesterday how Krishna consciousness means to see the universe as the Lord did. So actually people, you know, they had to be qualified brahmanas. They were not necessarily devotees, but Prabhupada himself said after they would get the chance to drink soma rasa, then they would become kavis. Because you know how people, there's a perverted reflection, they get drunk on unmentionable beverages, and then you see them walking down the street and they're singing some song and talking all kinds of nonsense. They sort of become, you know, poets of incomprehension. Incomprehensible. And a lot of times, you know, now it's pretty, it's pretty much accepted. Prabhupada himself used to do these wonderful imitations. He, you know, I can't do it, because he would actually use real syllables that were, I guess he would take Sanskrit dhatus and just jumble them up so they meant nothing. But he did it very expertly. There's one lecture where you hear him do it. I won't even try to imitate it. Because, you know, we just make sounds, you know, but he would speak in a way that sounded like words, but they had no meaning. He's just jumbling dhatus, you know. He would always go back to Sanskrit dhatus. When he would imitate the sound of a, like you hear, can you hear the pump? Yeah. So when he would imitate that, he would go praka 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 praka, which is prakra iti prakriti. And one of the definitions of prakriti is machine. So you'd be getting the Sanskrit even from these, it's called onomatopoeia.
Yeah, onomatopoeia.
Yeah. It's like words that imitate the sound. The Prabhupada would do that, but it made sense. There was the logic to it. And I can't do that, so I'm not going to make a fool of myself if I'm trying. And generally, we in the West don't know how to do that. We just make animal sounds, you know. Babbling brook sounds of nature. The Prabhupada would actually, this is logic again. This is logical. It's going back to logos or words, you know. So again, and this brings us back to the subject of ontology. So let's please continue. So the materialistic conception of the universe means The universe is here for eating, drinking, being merry, for life is but a dream, as Prabhupada explains, or as Sri Krishna explains in the 16th chapter. That's how they look at the universe, the demons. So that conception, which is seeming, I mean, it's covering the world population today. Look at the t-shirts the Bengalis around here are wearing. You know, look at their t-shirts. They're in English, and sometimes you can't, you don't want to repeat the message that's on the t-shirt. You know, you can't do that in a polite audience, you know. So it's covering the consciousness of the human being all over the world, but as stated here, it cannot cover the Lord's virya, his power as vira. Virat simply means, as Prabhupada said, his separated power. Prabhupada gave this wonderful example of a tape recorder. You know, or now we have CDs and DVDs, and we listen to Prabhupada's lecture, and what do we get? What do you, you know, you all listen to Prabhupada's lectures, I hope and pray. And as they say in the Christian churches, you feel the power! Yeah, we feel the power! Yes, Lord, we feel the power! It's coming right through. The power is there in the tape recording. But that's Prabhupada's virat. It's separated. It's not Prabhupada himself personally, because you can't ask the tape, you know, questions and get an answer from it. Although the tape will answer all your questions anyway if you listen carefully enough and enough times. All the answers will be there. Or, you know, maybe you have to get a few tapes. But anyway, you know, since Prabhupada is just talking Bhagavatam, so finally all the answers will be there. But when the Lord is there in question, then his virya is, you know, it's in that is, that actual eternal now. That's the interesting thing, is that now that we can't catch is eternality, is the sat, but we can't quite catch it. When we use the word now, you all know what I mean. But if I ask you, please write a dissertation on now, you can't do it. As soon as you put the words down on paper, that now is gone. And it's been studied, you know, scientists have studied, you know, when you get down to the workings of the nervous system, that takes time too. You know, so the thought process is, you know, even on the level of thought, you can never catch it. Although we all know what it is, because we're spirit soul, and that now is eternal. So what separates us from now is time. And that's part of the Lord's, you know, that's a very important aspect of the Lord's virat. We were talking about that yesterday, time factor. So even though the demons in the modes of Raja Tamoguna strive with all their might, and we are talking about right now, this is an important thing we have to understand. We have to understand, I'm sorry, and I'm taking up, but I wasn't here for 5 days. So I deserve one class session. My Adolf instincts are coming on now. Someone mentioned yesterday, because I recently shaved up, but I left a little accidentally here. So that little mustache is drunk. I gotta go quickly shave it off. You know, tomorrow I'll even be worse. I'll start talking in German. Anyway, Yet they're striving with all their might, and they're striving with all their might right now. It's not Hiranyakasipu, it's not Ravana. I mean, it is them, the spirit. But these demons are here on earth right now. I want to give you an example. Or two examples. Let me give you two examples. Now, when I tell you this, it's going to strike some of you as, you know, you're going to think, oh, this guy must be reading, you know, these weird John Birch Society books, or, you know, this far out fringe, you know, these wackos write about, you know, the flying saucers, and they're in league with the U.S. government, and, you know, the technology is coming from outer space, and in return for that, the government is letting the aliens abduct people and do experiments on them in their spaceships. You know, there's, you know, you may think that it's coming from that, but it's not. This has been proven, because the United States government has admitted it, because it was investigated by determined reporters who dragged out it like pulling teeth. They had to drag out these secrets, and finally, 40, 50 years later, the U.S. government admitted and had to pay millions of dollars in restitution. So it's definitely true. So I'm going to give you two examples. How many know where the spread of LSD in American society went? Where and when it started? How many think it was in the 1960s with the hippie movement? You're not raising your hands. Oh.
Timothy Leary.
Huh?
Timothy Leary.
Timothy Leary. Okay. That's what we've all been brought up to think.
Vietnam.
But the actual truth is it started right after the Second World War by the CIA. And the way they were doing it, they were walking into coffee shops, total strangers, and slipping LSD into their coffee. And they would sit and order themselves a cup of coffee and a piece of pie and just sit there and watch what would happen to a person and take notes. And then they started, you know, they started these drug houses. I mean, you know, there's like drug pushers, you know, they'll rent a house. Special house. People know, you know, it's not, of course, they don't put advertisements in the newspaper, but everyone, you know, the underground, the young people know this house in the neighborhood, you go there, you can get some good stuff. They don't use the word stuff, they use another word which begins with S, but anyway, never mind. And so the CIA was opening such drug places, offering drugs. You know, they would say we've got good grass, we've got good heroin, but the only thing they would give was LSD. And this is like in 1945, 46, 47, before anyone knew what LSD was. No one even knew what LSD was, and they were just studying. And it wasn't until 1958. When they tested it on one of their own men, without telling it, another CIA agent, they slipped it in his coffee, and he happened to be in a skyscraper building, and he jumped out of the 11th floor window. And it was said to be a suicide, and in the clause, I mean, you know, the contract you sign when you are admitted to the CIA, it means if you kill yourself, then your family doesn't get any benefits, you know. So the family didn't get any benefits because the CIA said the guy committed suicide, and they knew damn well why. Because we slipped him a tab of LSD. But they didn't want to admit it because it was a top secret program. And you know what they were trying to do? by using this LSD. This was a part of a program called MK Ultra, and the whole purpose is mind control. They wanted to be able to take an ordinary person out of, you know, like a librarian or a doctor, respectable person, condition him in some way so that by some signal, subconscious suggestion, then he would go out and murder someone, you know, assassinate someone that they would tell. That means, you know, say Fidel Castro comes to the United Nations to give a speech, comes to New York, and a total stranger, John Q. Public, who has no connection to the government at all, is given that signal, and he just happens to have a pistol that he bought himself. You know, this is a lone gunman scenario, and he walks up and he shoots Fidel Castro in the head, or whoever it is, Premier Khrushchev, and kills him. And the American government says, "We had nothing to do with that." And, you know, of course, no one believes them, but you can't find the connection. That's what they were looking for, the perfect assassin. That's why they're doing all. And they did these tests for 20 years. And so you think that that's far out. And I want to remind you again, the United States government admitted to this, and they paid millions of dollars, because that family of that CIA man who jumped out the window, they figured out what happened. And they brought charges to the government, and the government lost the case. The government tried, the federal government, the United States, tried to avoid responsibility for this, and they lost the case. That's what I mean by demons running the world. And then the next example, if you thought that was far off, was their experience with plutonium. The same thing. Does everyone know what plutonium is? It's a radioactive isotope that is produced by the explosion of atomic and hydrogen bombs. It's an extremely deadly poison. Once you get it in your system, you can never get it out. It goes into the bone marrow and it literally rots your body from the inside. And they went around doing the same thing in hospitals, injecting it in citizens. We're coming, you know, just to get, someone would come in, like, "Doctor, I've got a flu, you know, or I've got a cold I can't get rid of," and the doctor happened to be working for the CIA, and he said, "Oh, I've got just the thing for you." And he would, you know, the old, the needle, he'd fill it up with liquefied, you know, water or whatever it was, mixed with plutonium, radioactive plutonium, and he'd inject it in the person. And the person would get cancer, incurable cancer, and die. And this was exposed, and a reporter who exposed it, a lady reporter, just recently, not long ago, she won Pulitzer Prize. U.S. government had to admit it. And you know what they said when they admitted it? They said, "That was President Eisenhower. We don't do that anymore." You know, you can view, like they say, what is it saying? Anyway, I forgot, but don't believe it. You know, now there's all this suspicion about 9/11, those planes flying into the skyscrapers in New York. There are real reasons for being very suspicious about that. So I'm sorry, it's now 9 o'clock and I've held my court. We haven't gotten too far because I'm such a blabbermouth. So day after tomorrow, Maharaj will take the lead. He's a much better teacher than I am because he moves faster. I got all these wacky things I have to say. because I live in an underground tomb. I don't see people for weeks sometimes. When I come out, I got so many things I have to say, and it's all muddy. So please excuse me. But maybe you learn something today. All I wanted to establish is that the world is really being run by demons, serious demons. And if you think that they stopped just because they were exposed, we don't, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg. We don't know what they're up to. And there are indications, like infrasound. Infrasound means sound below the level of human hearing. And there is said to be a level. And you see, this is what I was talking yesterday about, if the scientists get into Vedic knowledge, so this is mantra, principle of mantra. And if they can get computers to exactly reproduce, you know, because it's all mechanical, on the level of Purva Mimamsa and on the level of yoga, Prabhupada always says it's just mechanistics. So if they can make computers good enough to duplicate certain sound vibrations, then they can actually take over your mind. They'll actually be able to do that. And they say, you know, they're exploring especially infrasound, sound below, like dog whistles are higher, but there are sounds below, and they've made some headway, I've heard. But this they've seen indications this changes people's behavior, so they're working like men. It's the military. The military leads all this, because it's all for weapons, it's all for ruling the world. And we are the only line of defense against this. Because those people I was telling you about yesterday, they're the same people. Presenting Vedic knowledge for the use of demoniac purposes. So that's why we're having this Bhagavatam class. And that's why I'm such a lousy teacher. Because we never make much progress. But what I think I, you know, the points I'm telling you are the real, you know, the ground reasons why it's so important to deeply study the Bhagavatam. Please do not dismiss this as just idle intellectualism, waste of time, because this is the real front of the fight, and we have to be armed for it, because that fight is going to come up. And where are we going to be? Where are we going to be when if that day comes? And now it is feasible, where the scientists can, because Prabhupada already said that one mystic Maharaj passed through the underground, and Prabhupada said they already do it with subways. So what if they start this, you know, beam me up Scotty stuff, you know, teleportation of the human body instantaneously from one place to another? Where are we going to be? I mean, the people are, you know, their minds are going to be so blown by this, they're just going to be tools in the hand. They'll just completely surrender to the scientists. And of course, we'll have the Hare Krishna mantra and we'll be blissful, but they're going to, people will be thinking, what's it got? I mean, these mantras, the mantras of the scientists really do things, far out things, you know. So we've got to be aware of these issues. So that's why I write these study guides like we do. And this is just introduction. The deeper we go into it, the more I'm going to go into it. And you may find it hard to keep up with, I admit that, but you have to know what was Prabhupada's purpose in writing the Bhagavad. Why do you think he wrote those books? So we can decorate our shelves, so that we can prove to our friends, devotee friends who are coming over, yeah, I got Prabhupada's books. Never read them. There they are on the shelf. We're supposed to be deeply studying. Bhakti Tru Maharaj, he asked me, he saw me I guess it was about a month ago, and he asked me, he didn't know what I was doing, but he said, you're staying in Mayapur, what are you doing? Then I told him, and he just put his arms around me. And he started crying, and he said, this is what we're all supposed to be doing. I started crying too. He said, this is what we're all supposed to be doing. deeply studying the Srimad Bhagavatam. So, I thank you very much for listening to my sermon from the pulpit. And I apologize for being such a wacko. But maybe some of the things I said have, in some deranged way, some importance. You should take it to heart. So, class is over, and we'll see you day after tomorrow. Hare Krishna. Thank you very much. Our voice to Shri Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.